Morning. A reading from Reverend Victoria Weinstein. On the advice of a Wiccan friend who said she was tired of hearing me make insulting and ignorant remarks about Christians, I read Thomas Harper's For Christ's Sake, which sent me straight back to the Gospels with a different perspective, a liberal religious perspective, and that stopped me cold. I had found my path, but I feared it could not coexist with my own and my family's intellectual orientation, my affiliation with Unitarian Universalism, or my loyalty to my Jewish roots. But where was Jesus in our UU worship life? I had never once questioned his absence in my childhood church, but now I began to wonder. Since Jesus's radical inclusivity, love of humanity, and passion for justice was so harmonious with all the good news I was hearing in our congregations, why did our ministers and our congregants so assiduously avoid the Gospels? I found it comical on some Sundays, depressing other Sundays, and consistently baffling. I could not understand why UUs would allow perversions of the religious right to define the word Christian, or religious for that matter, why they would concede religious language to the conservatives, and why they would go out of their way to construct a religion intentionally bereft of theology, rendering themselves a quasi-religion and many of their churches temples of denial and hypocrisy, where every spiritual path but the Christian path was considered valid, and where evidence of a Christian past was removed, revised, and painted over. It took 10 more years of committed Unitarian Universalist life for me to consider that perhaps my dear UUs were the most strangely faithful Christians of all. Having either intuitively or consciously embraced Jesus's gospel of love, service, and justice, they could not stand to affiliate with any so-called faithful who claimed to have received their inspiration from discrimination, exclusion, superstition, and damnation from that same source. The well, for too many UUs, had been irrevocably poisoned, and they would thereafter drink of the living waters from another source. Any other source, it seemed, but the Christian well.
There was no doubt about it. I did not want to write poetry. I was an undergrad creative writing major who wrote neo-Gothic prose heavy on atmosphere. I did not write poetry. So I sat in the student advisor's office at USC, and I explained all of this to the woman opposite me, and she listened oh so patiently and then said, "I understand. But every creative writing major is required to take one poetry class. Many of them," she looked at me, "find they even learn something." If my brain could roll its eyes, I'm sure it did. I steeled myself for the waste of time I knew that class would be. We'll get back to that in a moment, but what I want to start with is that sometimes people wonder what goes on in Unitarian Universalist religious education classes for children. Among learning about making ethical decisions, they are also taught that the world's greatest spiritual teachers and who they are. For instance, in one of our other UU congregations, I heard that a teacher asked a little girl, "Can you tell us what happened on Easter Sunday?" Of course, that little girl knew the answer. "Jesus rolled back the stone, walked outside, and saw his shadow." So we have 6 more weeks of winter. So that's to say that sometimes we in religious liberal communities maybe don't pay too much attention to Jesus. But being part of a religious tradition that prides itself on its rational roots, we should at the very least, understand the historical Jesus. How do we find him? Now, for the most part, scholars have come to some of the same basic conclusions. Jesus was likely a real person, and the Christian scriptures were assembled from a source document they've named Q. This document predates the biblical gospels and contains sayings of Jesus that were then incorporated into the narratives of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Not so much John, mostly Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Scholar Bart Ehrman primarily sees Jesus as one of several apocalyptic teachers of the time. He believed that the world had a very short time left to exist before God's kingdom would come to it. Now, Ehrman believes that Jesus likely told his disciples that when God came, he, Jesus, would be a king. Beyond that, Jesus probably never said anything about being the Son of God. Moreover, his so-called resurrection can be attributed to visions his followers had after his death, dreams of the teacher and leader they missed so much. So the greatness of Jesus, at the time that he lived anyway, was in his humanity as a teacher and prophet. David St. John is a poet. An unassuming man, he didn't ostentatiously sweep into that poetry class like Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. He wasn't about tricks or gimmicks to get your attention. He was about the poetry. Often, he told us, I get messages from people I don't know. Now, I always know what it will be that they're calling about before I ever call them back. It will be someone who has just lost a loved one, and they need help finding a poem that expresses their grief. He explained that in those pivotal moments, it was to poetry and other forms of expression that people turned, forms of expression that expressed the ultimately inexpressible. Interesting, but I still knew I wasn't a poet. Jesus, too, has been used as a vehicle for people to express the inexpressible. How do you adequately explain the centrality of goodness and caring for your neighbor? You have a great story with a central teacher figure that does it for you. In the book Christ for Unitarian Universalists, Scotty McLennan says that as a teacher, Jesus radically critiqued the social and political order of his world. He stood on the side of the dispossessed and protested the ancient domination system that surrounded him, which was characterized by patriarchy, hierarchy, and an economics of exploitation. Sounds exactly like what we use are called to do today. But McLennan makes the argument that it's not enough to see Jesus as an historical figure alone because his influence has been so great in the hearts and actions of artists and poets, social reformers and innovators, healers and peacemakers. Thus, we move beyond the historical Jesus to the Christ figure, as McLennan provocatively calls him. McLennan knows full well that the only time Christ is usually said in UU churches is when someone stubs their toe. But Jesus Christ, to try on this more evocative term just for the moment, serves as an emotive force that holds power in both the personal and spiritual realms and social realms. The same is true of the other great spiritual teachers like the Buddha. Now, we may or may not identify as Buddhist, but the wisdom of the Buddha can be tapped into as something that ignites our deeper spiritual selves. Yet McLennan keeps on the side of rationality and does not advocate for a supernatural Jesus atoning for the sins of humankind. Instead, he sees the Christ figure as available for Unitarian Universalists wanting to come closer to understanding our fundamental principles, everything from the inherent worth and dignity of each person to the goal of a world community. In other words, the Christ figure, in all its poetic multiplicity, can serve as a catalyst for heartfelt spiritual and ethical discernment. But what do we do? What do we do when so much of Christianity has been used to uphold the very kinds of oppressions that you use look to dismantle? Howard Thurman, the African-American theologian who expressed humanist, Christian, and Unitarian Universalist leanings in his work, proving that these can coexist in one human being, said that the basic fact is that Christianity, as it was born in the mind of this Jewish thinker and teacher, appears as a technique of survival for the oppressed. That it became, through the intervening years, a religion of the powerful and dominant, used sometimes as an instrument of oppression, must not tempt us into believing that it was thus in the mind of the and life of Jesus. It can be easy to forget this essential fact when we see Jesus used in the name of so much we abhor. A rational and a spiritual approach to a figure like Jesus invites us to separate ourselves from the cultural misuse we have witnessed. And for some of us, that might mean re-examining what we once rejected. And so, as we were asked to do for our first assignment in that poetry class, I set out to write a poem. I found myself at the laundromat, of all places. I sat there with pen and paper, watching the clothes tumble around in the washer windows, waiting for inspiration. What did I want to say? I asked myself. No. My instructor, David St. John, had said it was more than that. What did I need to say? In the hubbub of that grimy laundromat, from somewhere within me, the words came. A cry from the soul, thoughts and feelings I hadn't known were there. Before the washer had even alerted me with its buzz, I had filled 3 pages. Now, you may not know much about the process of becoming a hospital chaplain. You have to complete an intensive program where after your daily rounds of being with the sick and dying, you sit in a circle with other chaplains from different faith traditions and reflect theologically on your work for hours. For some, this might be one of the circles of hell Dante didn't write about. Chaplaincy programs pride themselves on their diversity. I discovered very quickly that Unitarian Universalists often represent the whole of that diversity. When I was a chaplain, my circle consisted of a Catholic priest in training, a Presbyterian, a very conservative Lutheran, and a Methodist. They struggled with the fact that I, as a Unitarian Universalist, didn't identify as Christian, so much so that the Lutheran once suggested that as a non-Christian hospital chaplain, I could be seen by the patients as a wolf in sheep's clothing, though he didn't necessarily personally feel that way. You could see why I chose to barely touch on my brand of atheism or theism, depending upon how you look at it, because I just did not want their heads to explode. Anyway, on the last session of this group, we had to write no-holds-barred reflections on each of our fellow chaplains, everything we'd observed over these hours and hours together. The Methodist was perhaps the most forthcoming. He wrote, and I kept this, "I do not understand why Jason, a Unitarian Universalist, is the most Christ-like member of this group. He does not call himself a Christian, but yet his approach to ministry displays more ethical attributes we associate with Jesus than anyone else here. His efforts to have meaningful interactions with every patient, no matter their religious affiliation, seems like the most Christian example of any of us." And then he added, quite angrily, "I no longer believe Jason is not a Christian. I think he is just confused." So I tried to tell him I really didn't have that much in common with Jesus Christ, except maybe my initials, but I don't think that's true. Even then, I knew enough to not take that as some sort of personal compliment. I'm the first to admit that I was primarily completing the program as a necessary requirement for the process of becoming a parish minister. I wasn't called to being a hospital chaplain. But this group member wasn't complimenting me. He was reluctantly, very reluctantly, complimenting Unitarian Universalism. Because I had approached chaplaincy with all the values instilled in me through Unitarian Universalism, I behaved in what he saw as a Christ-like manner. And that made me stop and think. I'd spent a lot of time telling the group I wasn't a Christian, but what did it mean to be part of a UU faith tradition that has so much rooted in one of the great ethical teachers of all time? Being too married to labels, I discovered, can sometimes close us off from other ways of understanding ourselves. As we turned in our poems, I glanced at the other students around me. I could see the sparse lines on their pages, lines that looked so restrained and elegant next to the denseness of my poem, whose lines filled not just one page but three, and suddenly I wondered if I had any idea of what poetry was. Had I even written a poem? What had I turned in? Was this even poetry? I think spiritual growth is a lot like my experience with poetry. We often think we don't need it, but the impulses that attract we humans to poetry or religion are universal ones. The question is, how do we respond to them? Especially when something like religion or poetry, unlike poetry, has been used as a tool to wage war and oppress. We should certainly throw the dirty bathwater out, but let's be sure not to throw the baby with it. So David St. John spoke to the class. I have your poems from last week. There are a few here that I want you to take a look at. My stomach sank as he began passing out the photocopies. He was going to show us what real poems look like, and I knew mine certainly didn't qualify. And there on the top of that stack, handed to me by the student in front of me, was my poem. Let's start with this one, he said. Now, it wasn't a very good poem in some ways, and the class critiqued it accordingly. But I was delighted that my professor had affirmed it did indeed qualify as a poem. And for all its flaws, he said, it's really interesting, not what you'd expect, but then sometimes we find our truth when we're looking where we don't expect. And thus, we keep looking for truth and meaning, as our principles call us to do, even sometimes in places we think there is nothing left for us. In the context of history, it matters a great deal who Jesus was as an apocalyptic preacher and Jew. In the context of spirituality, there is another component. For those who welcome Jesus into their lives as a spiritual teacher, just as those who might welcome in the Buddha or Muhammad, the importance is that they make space for the ethical teachings to change them in ways that lift up the best of who they can be. As Howard Thurman said, wherever his spirit appears, the oppressed gather fresh courage. We Unitarian Universalists need to make sure we are willing to dip our bucket into whatever well might provide one or others of us with that fresh courage. How then can we look at that great Jewish rabbi Jesus' teachings in an invitational way as conduits of learning for us? How could we open ourselves up beyond the intellectual realm to the poetic realm of teachings that are maybe outside our immediate comfort zones? I'm sure my poetry professor, David St. John, doesn't know the effect he had on me in beginning to connect me with my poetic soul, if you will. That's the thing about really great teachers. They bring out things in us we cannot see ourselves. That first poem I wrote eventually became the first sermon I ever delivered. This proves to me the importance of opening myself up to unlikely teachers, even perhaps something like Jesus, who I once thought I had outgrown. Perhaps I haven't. And we do this work now of opening ourselves up beyond our biases because we are called to grow. A minister said to me this week, We mainline Christian churches have it hard right now. People don't want any part of who they think we are. But you, Unitarian Universalists, offer something different. And people are looking for something different right now. With the rise of so much that's challenging in our social sphere, people need a community to ground themselves in, free of the oppressive baggage that comes with some religions. Yet we Unitarian Universalists call ourselves a multi-faith tradition. It's on all of our websites. We don't call ourselves a non-faith tradition. And to meet the needs of budding Unitarian Universalists requires an informed, responsible relationship to the world's major religions. Some newcomers come to us rejecting Christianity, but some come wanting a new relationship with at least elements of it, one rooted in rationality, but also spiritually open. And when we are truly open, and this goes for those who might come to us as Jewish Unitarian Universalists or Hindu Unitarian Universalists or Muslim Unitarian Universalists, imagine what we can be as a community. We can be a community that has more spiritually whole people, a congregation that has more programming to meet the needs of those people, one that is an unmistakable presence in this community, seen as a force for social change with our numbers, our energy, our passion for justice, that is known for the quality of its music program, its religious education program, its Sunday services, that pays its staff appropriately for their time and gifts, that is poised to properly respond to the crises in the lives of its members and in the larger community. We can be all those things when we are bigger, stronger, building on the values that have shaped us the last 50 years now. But we have to be open to do that, to change, to theological diversity, to other kinds of diversity, to anything we may encounter along the way. And when we do all of this, what do we find at the end? In the clear light of the dawning of a new day, we find our best selves.